ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to the final in ABC Radio National's Boyer Lecture Series for 2025. I'm Julia Baird, and thus far our previous four speakers have offered compelling insights into the theme of Australia's unique, radical experiment in democracy, both its strengths and vulnerabilities in a world where democracy is in decline. In this lecture, author and professor of modern history from Sydney University, James Curran, in a pointed and powerful address entitled Trump's Gift, identifies the opportunities the presidency of Donald Trump now presents. James argues we're at a watershed moment where Australia needs to openly discuss a plan B, should an increasingly, if selectively, isolationist and erratic America choose not to prioritise or honour our historical alliance. We have the chance now, he says, to have the debates too many political leaders shy from and work to strengthen defence and trade partnerships within the Pacific region as a whole. I'm pleased now to welcome James Curran.
This lecture is about the opportunity Donald Trump's presidency gives Australia to recover its own distinctive voice in world affairs. We are experiencing another bout of panic about whether or not we are loved by America and whether America will be there for us. This kind of panic has gripped elements of the national security system at least once, if not several times every decade, since wartime Prime Minister John Curtin looked to America in 1941. We seem incapable of relinquishing the chronic anxiety about access to American power, protection, and affection. We remain fundamentally unable to determine when we need to depart from US strategy and the moments we need to align with it. Rather, it seems we prefer to stew about when the Prime Minister will meet President Trump face to face, avert our eyes to Trump's contempt for close allies, assuming he will spare us the same, fret over a Pentagon review of AUKUS, the cancellation of which might allow us to focus more fully on the question of how to adequately defend ourselves, and we hand-wring and hair-pull about who a minister sees or doesn't see in Washington. The result is debilitating to our national self-worth and confidence. As a country, we have talked ourselves into a loss of agency. The visceral craving for the US alliance has led to a dumbing down of our foreign policy with a concomitant lack of ambition and imagination. Trump cares little for alliances, so his presidency could well offer a priceless gift to Australia, a rare moment when national self-interest can eclipse sentiment. The jolt to get on with the job of thinking through what the possible end of Pax Americana means for our foreign policy and our trade policy in particular. It is important now to avoid a repeat of what happened when Britishness collapsed in the late 1960s, the clinging on to a fading strategic landscape, hoping for the return of an old friend. We're in this position not just because of Trump. We are in it because our sense and the environment of national security have changed so much since the end of the Vietnam War. The intelligence assessments then forecast strategic quiet, that the country faced no direct external threat over the following 15 years. So governments of both persuasions pursued comprehensive engagement with Asia. The US alliance remained central, but it was not invested with either new content or meaning. From 1996, however, Asia was predominantly viewed in practical terms. Asia first, but not Asia only, as John Howard put it, thereby pulling off the remarkable feat of relegating the region even as he prioritised it. The US alliance was not only venerated, but placed up atop a pedestal alongside the Anzac legend, bronzed, untouchable, immutable. Now, this is not to lionise a golden age of Australian regional engagement, but even today, it's a fair bet, despite the success of our recent diplomacy in Southeast Asia and the Pacific, that thanks largely to AUKUS and the bequeathing of so much of our continent to the US military, many Asian capitals still see the stars and stripes tattooed brightly across our strategic derriere. But events are now turning against Australian establishment perceptions of the world. The US alliance, which has become a way of international life for much of Australia's national security community, is paradoxically characterised by the deepest military integration in its 74-year history, yet beset by more doubt than at any point in its past. Australia's instinct seems to be to grit its teeth and hope for American renewal in 2030, though Trump represents deep structural change in the United States. The wonder remains, given decades of socioeconomic stress in the American heartland and its foreign policy misadventures in Iraq and Afghanistan, why it took so long for a Trump-like figure to reach the White House. Trump's successes may be less affronting, less crude or vulgar, perhaps even less brash in putting America first. But this is likely to be the long-term normal in terms of how the US thinks and acts about the world. It is American exceptionalism in its purest form, self-obsessed, self-righteous, but minus the missionary impulse to spread democracy or its nation-building agenda around the world. Australia is pigging in the middle of US-China strategic and economic competition. But we have relinquished much of a sense of our agency. This is a serious problem for our diplomacy. What then are the problems that Prime Minister Albanese has to grapple with? We are in the middle because we have interests on both sides, and the heightened US-China tensions not only serve none of our interests, it imperils them, threatening the real prospect of war. The situation requires harder thinking about how we compensate for US policy shifts in an atmosphere of rising Chinese confidence. How did we get here? Let me deal with the United States first. For Australia, the United States has since the early post-war years been at the core of our defence planning. We believed we had a cultural affinity with America too, though that always masked the real differences in social and political ideals and experiences of nationalism, differences that are coming into sharper relief now. Over the past few decades, however, these defining differences in the respective political cultures have often been smothered by a thick, oozing syrup of mateship and men before the mast. We have convinced ourselves that the sharing of common values formed an unbreakable bond to a limitless future. As Scott Morrison once put it, 100 years of mateship would turn into 100 more. These shibboleths were comforting, but they now meet the blunt realities of a rapidly changing world. Whether America is still the one for Australia is a question that probably lies beyond Trump, but his worldview is surely the spur to think anew. Biden continued much of the thrust of the first Trump administration's policies, and although vestiges of past US policies peeped through, the return of Trump has crystallised the change. Those key changes are, firstly, the tariff war of the past 8 months, which has shown just how access to the huge American market feeds Trump's belief that he has opportunity to exercise presidential power, a power which he can wield unreservedly across the world and in a manner unprecedented for America's allies. The focal point of this US trade war is China, yet so far, it has suffered the least. Rarely in peacetime has such aggressive action been taken against a trading partner. The result of the ensuing volatility and confusion in Washington is that America's allies in the Pacific have eroding trust in America. In practical ways across the trade, security and investment domains, the US-led post-war world has gone. Trump's Washington is totally self-interested and has downgraded partners and allied interests in a way not seen in the United States since before World War II. Yet large sections of Australia's political class, along with its think tanks, still refuse to acknowledge it. These chill winds from America blow in at the same time as China's rise unsettles. Xi Jinping has changed the nature of the Communist Party's administration of the state, though the party's control obviously predates Xi and will post-date him whoever takes over. The party and Xi have a worldview matching its domestic policy framework, that is, people should do what they are told and accede to Chinese interests. While the Chinese Communist Party is embedded in an authoritarian state, we still have to deal with the reality of China and fashion our own path towards economic and military security in that relationship. The level of China's military build-up invites the obvious conclusion that must have been drawn in Beijing, namely that it was a challenge that would confront and might check the US and its allies in policy and military terms. China has now the capacity to resist intimidation by the US, but which great state would not prepare to be in that position? Then there's China's trade coercion of Australia from 2020. Now, it clearly weaponised trade for political purposes. That reality should not be relinquished, but there's another side of reality. Our critical iron ore trade was not attacked then, and that relationship didn't change. And Beijing settled the dispute within the framework of international trade law and the regime that also insulated Australia from serious damage from China's trade embargoes. Finding an equivalent source of iron ore might not be a reasonable prospect for China for another two decades or so. But the point is that both countries are caught in the deep embrace of complementarity and the trade regime that fostered it, and from which neither can escape. Australia may have been foolish in its megaphone diplomacy with China, but the Chinese response was unreasonable and a warning for the future. The debate here in Australia about China so often allows unanchored fear to unbalance informed calculation. As historians have long pointed out, the aim must be to achieve a favourable defence posture without intensifying the very threat which it is hoped will be averted. Now, that may be difficult, but it is not impossible. At the same time, Trump's Washington recognises that the US industrial base that underpins its military might is greatly weakened, so the pressure on allies to do more is greater. The United States is now publicly and privately confronting the Albanese government over whether it will commit to joining American forces in planning to defend Taiwan from a Chinese takeover. So the confrontation is not just about defence spending or the delivery to Australia of US nuclear submarines under the AUKUS arrangements. The message is that the US alone does not offer credible deterrence to China, and that key allies, including Japan, South Korea and Australia, must commit now to providing unequivocal support to the deterrent power of American forces to make China pause in any military intervention to take control of Taiwan. Given the nature of the Trump administration, the tensions with Australia could easily blow up into a major crisis, one that tests or badly wounds the ANZUS alliance. Some public intellectuals and strategists say that Australia can join this war planning now, but take the sovereign decision to not activate and operate it if conflict broke out. But as the major contribution by Australia in war planning would be the use of the US facilities, bases and logistics hubs in Australia that the US has established with our agreement, then we would have to cut power to Pine Gap in Alice Springs and elsewhere, and even block the tarmac at air bases to make that sovereign decision. Now, that would be virtually impossible to do if we should agree to joint war planning. So because the US bases in Australia would be targets for Chinese missiles in such a war, this decision on American requests is without doubt a vital issue right now. But so far as one can tell, it is being fudged. In the minds of the Trump Pentagon, Australia's commitment to preserving the defence of the first island chain, that is, the defensive arc drawn by American policymakers at the dawn of the Cold War, running from Japan through Okinawa, Taiwan and the Philippines, is urgent and needs to be resolved, even though President Trump has not even vaguely suggested that his dealings with China might imply a commitment to Taiwan's defence or Australia's. It should be remembered that the ANZUS Treaty is a commitment to consult only. Its thin assurance can now be ignored. The only reason the United States would activate the ANZUS Treaty is if its own security was threatened by, for example, Chinese military activity around Taiwan that the US chose to challenge, threats to the sea lanes of the Pacific, or, perhaps less likely given the US nuclear deterrent, Chinese, North Korean or Russian threats to launch missiles at the US homeland. ANZUS would not be a certain shield for Australia, even if we joined the US in a war with China, and the Americans would like to help. And that in itself is not certain in US minds. As for AUKUS, it will prove to be a smokescreen behind which Australian governments of the past 6 years have pretended to be doing something special and innovative to fortify the alliance relationship, while delaying practical armaments and giving new expression and effect to what the defence of Australia requires. This agreement was designed on the back of an envelope and without the basic due diligence required for a vast whole-of-nation enterprise. It has now spawned an entire industry of hillbillies and hangers-on, all with their snouts deep in the trough of the military-industrial complex. No US nuclear submarines will be available to us in the early 2030s, except maybe on the basis that some are under US command and they carry some Australian sailors. It is impossible to read the publicly available material in Washington and believe otherwise. AUKUS has become a template for the US-Australia alliance as a whole, but it is a common currency freighted with unfulfilled expectations on both sides. Its massive cost and dubious strategic opportunity are being maintained despite the patent uselessness for Australian sovereign defence. It seems to be aimed more at placating the hawks in Australia and the US at an eye-watering cost. The absurd 50-year treaty with the UK means that at some point we may get a submarine built in Britain and a design we may build in Australia. If the US nuclear submarines are excluded as sovereign weapons platforms, as they have to be, then the delivery date is entirely dependent on UK industry and its Ministry of Defence, and that surely is allowing hope to dictate to judgment. So if the old rules are dead as of now, the question is, how adept can Australia be in adapting to a different world? We have made a start under the current government. Our straddle diplomacy is about speaking frankly to both the US and China. To Washington, the Prime Minister has sent a reminder of that tradition in Australian foreign policy where Canberra, knowing that great powers often play fast and loose with Australia's interests, can express its independence both within and without the alliance. The Hawke-Keating governments struck the best balance here. Albanese is standing firm on American demands for greater defence spending, just as Trade Minister Don Farrell is emphatic on Australia wanting to do more, not less, business with China. To Beijing, the Prime Minister went in measured terms beyond the policy of stabilisation into the realm of fulsome but selective engagement on greening the iron and steel business. At the same time, he stood firm on foreign investment rules and the ownership of Darwin Port. In Beijing earlier this year, Albanese was clear. The country has differences with China, but those differences should not define the relationship. How should Australia approach these two key relationships? How, if we wanted to, could we move closer to China and preserve our safety in a possible conflict between the United States and China? We should continue working on the decarbonisation agenda with Beijing as a way to fortify the bilateral relationship and make it stronger in the event of future political headwinds. We should also continue to press China to lock in behind its multilateral trade rhetoric. Yes, the nature of the regime in Beijing may make cultural and deep intimacy with its authorities, as distinct from the Chinese people, unpalatable. Yet we have a large population of Australians with Chinese heritage who enrich Australian social and cultural life. But our only real aim beyond maintaining an open trading system is to keep the peace in the South China Sea and elsewhere in the wider area that the Chinese claim. This is no small ambition and should be, and to some extent is, the Albanese government's declared objective. Too often undiscussed in the so-called defence debate in Australia is the huge cost of even a relatively small non-nuclear conflict. Apart from the immediate and quite possibly catastrophic damage to Taiwan, the Chinese coast and probably Okinawa and US bases in Japan and possibly Australia, we need to remember the lasting enmity this kind of conflict would cause, not least within the loser states, and the desire for revenge and another bout that armed conflicts so often provoke. Escalation beyond a local conflict is inevitable. and the economic impact on Australia and its neighbours in the region would be devastating, rendering the Afghanistan and Iraq adventures akin to tea parties. What are the hoped-for fruits of such a senseless war? To give China final authority over Taiwan, or to preserve US primacy in the Pacific and East Asia? When it's put as bluntly as that, war is clearly a conflict without prizes. And yet it is a real possibility. So what can Australia do? First, we make avoiding war the principal objective for Australia and its near neighbours in Southeast Asia and the Pacific. We elevate keeping the status quo in Taiwan so that it be neither independent nor attached. We must work harder with Japan, Korea and ASEAN, and particularly Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, Singapore and the Philippines, to argue for that status quo for the long-term future. That means entrenching a framework within which to do that, and at the same time, engage with China constructively. We need to expand dramatically our cultural, political and economic relations with Indonesia. Not an easy task and not without significant challenges, but worth the generational effort. We need to develop a persuasive argument to ASEAN members to knit China much more closely into multilateral regional trade and economic structures that help to reinforce global rules, especially insisting that there should be no exclusion of trade from any nation in the region. Indonesia and Japan are the critical players we must persuade in this endeavour. Australia, therefore, cannot let all its options hang off the US alliance in some vain hope that regional strategic equilibrium is achievable. US primacy is not coming back. Some kind of new connective tissue is needed involving Australia and the region, building on existing cooperation with Japan, Korea, India, and Southeast Asia in ways that develop comprehensive regional, economic, and political security. Not as a quasi-NATO, but a mechanism that embeds norms and institutions for securing amity and commerce and practical cooperation for crisis management. The point is not that we cannot have an independent foreign policy. The point is that it doesn't need to be articulated by shaking cans of bully beef or dressing up the Eureka stockade incident in the borrowed robes of Gettysburg or the storming of the Bastille. We cannot be entirely independent of the US and China because their actions still have such a powerful influence upon us. And we need to retain influence in Washington and Beijing to press the cause of peace. That doesn't mean, though, that we remain joined at the hip to the preservation of US primacy, without thinking through properly what that means in the world to come, as multipolarity changes the contours of the regional balance of power. US-China competition is already creating its own turbulent force field, with Indonesia, Japan, Korea, and India each trying to find stability and security within the hurricane. That is likely to bring unforeseeable twists and turns over coming decades. So, we need to think about new relationships beyond the dominant paradigm of that of Canberra being home alone. Our diplomacy has to be stronger. We must recognise that we have agency. We start from a good place here, with a diplomatic tradition that is sometimes too quiet in projecting genuine achievements. The Cambodian Peace Accords, the Cairns Group, the creation of APEC and the APEC Leaders Summits, the Chemical and Nuclear Weapons Convention, East Timorese independence and inclusion in the East Asia Summit. And as historian Neville Meany once argued, unlike the Americans, who are possessed of such a self-conscious and self-sufficient nationalism that it is very difficult for them to enter into others' problems and alien experience, Australians, he said, are not inhibited by such defects. They possess a pragmatic, sceptical, humane tradition, which when harnessed to intellectual discipline provides the basis for a better kind of diplomacy. Could we untangle with this US president and then tangle with a more benign US president? That would be hard, if not impossible. There are undoubted difficulties of untangling from the US. Across the economic, cultural, foreign affairs and intelligence spheres, there is an intimacy not easily loosened, a result of the past two decades in particular of deepening military integration. But Trump may provide the provocation to think about redirecting the enormous amount of Australian strategic energy that is currently poured into the alliance. And yes, there might be risks of US reprisals, which would need to be thought about, but they could be handled. So perhaps our current policy is to be cautiously reactive with Trump in the short term. But it should not delay for a moment the new thinking required to navigate a world where the American connection is so fundamentally different from what it has been for the past three quarters of a century. We should not, however, be reactive on the diplomacy of avoiding war. Here, Australia needs to be more on the front foot and with greater conviction. That's just one of a series of challenges outlined in these Boyer Lectures over the last month. Each of my fellow speakers has highlighted the dangers of complacency to the character of our democratic culture and society. Australia and Australians have much to do in order to carry the best of what has been built here into the remainder of a century where history is likely to have more aces up its sleeve.
And I followed up James Curran's lecture with an interview, which you should be aware was recorded prior to the much-awaited meeting between Donald Trump and Anthony Albanese in October. I asked James why he thinks there is such urgency to our foreign policy debate.
Now, you argue, in fact, the title of your lecture is Trump's Gift, which you think Donald Trump could be a gift to the people of Australia in rethinking our potential. Do you think many politicians see him that way?
Probably not at this stage. I think there's a fair bit of panic. I think there's a fair bit of alarm about what Trump's doing to the international system, the kind of wrecking ball that he's swinging through a system that has served Australia very well. We haven't been hit by the highest tariffs. We've just got the baseline. But there is still, I think, a great deal of concern about what the AUKUS review, what that might throw up. And I suspect that could put us in some really tricky spots. We might be asked to pay even more into the industrial base. There might be more pressure on us to join in sort of joint war planning for a possible conflict over Taiwan. And I think that's going to push this government probably a little bit too far. And I think there's a real risk that, in fact, Washington could inflict some damage on the relationship.
And a potential for us to draw a line and say where we won't cross.
I think that has to be done at some point. If we are pushed to a level that is beyond our comfort zone and which is starting to threaten the key economic relationship with China, I think that's a no-go zone for Canberra. Now, this is getting more and more difficult, I think, Julia, because of the extent of integration. I mean, Trump is a gift in terms of, as I've argued, prompting us to think anew about this relationship into which so much emphasis and energy is being poured. But we've also made a continental gift to the United States by allowing so much of the north of the country, the centre, and now a new nuclear submarine base off the coast of Western Australia. You know, we are basically a launch pad for US warfighting in the Pacific. Now, how do we say no if the kite goes up, if there is, God forbid, a conflict? We've left ourselves very little room to move in terms of sovereign decision making. And that's a real problem. And I think the governments of recent years on both political sides have simply not earned the social license. This is one of the problems, I think, in terms of our democracy at the moment, is that politicians don't think they need to make a case anymore, a public case, an argument for something as big
as this. Persuasion.
Persuasion.
But what is it that's particularly happening with this, with our foreign policy? I mean, the words you use throughout your lecture about, you know, like there's a complacency, there's a lack of imagination, that there's something about our anxiety about our closeness to America that has kind of stultified us or narrowed our thinking.
Yeah.
And you also say that this political class in Australia, as well as think tanks, are just almost refusing to acknowledge what's happening in America and our need to shift our thinking. Why is that? Like, what's going on culturally there?
So I think the last sort of 25, 30 years in Australian politics, I mean, really since 1996, there has been such a massive emphasis on sort of giving the Americans more and more, right? It was there right from the beginning of the Howard Prime Ministership, this idea that somehow America was going to leave us alone again. I mean, it's populated our history at various moments. This has come in at a time when anxieties and concerns about China's rise and what that means. They have coincided, these two chill winds. Concern about where America is headed. Remember, we were never quite sure when Obama made the pivot to Asia what that would mean for Australia, so we gave them training facilities in Darwin. Then Tony Abbott gave them more and said that we can't think of America as a foreign country. I mean, that's the language that Menzies used to use about Britain. Mm. So we've actually kind of, in a way, I think, we're still engaging with Asia and the Pacific and we're doing good things there. But the dominant voice that we are projecting to the rest of the world is we are culturally, politically and diplomatically aligned with the United States. So I think the combination of fear of China and the way in which that has been whipped up into a frenzy at times, concern about abandonment by the great power, I think the two of them have come together and they've stoked this sense in which we just have to constantly think about what extra we can put into the alliance, because it always comes down to this idea of a kind of an insurance premium. We think the more we do, the more sure the alliance will be. So we pack it full of all these initiatives, thinking the Americans will come to defend us. Mm. Now, they did in World War II. Mm. That is irrefutable. But it's not clear that this America under Trump will necessarily follow that pattern.
Right. So we have an administration that is marked by volatility. Mm. And we also know that Donald Trump promised an isolationist foreign policy and spoke to that a lot during his campaign. And that's been very selective, has it not, during this time? So is that what is difficult for us to formulate a policy in terms of always being reactive when there's always so much to react to?
Exactly. And, I mean, the stuff that doesn't make sense. I mean, you know, at first you could make the argument that Trump was only going to be concerned with the Western Hemisphere, with Mexico, Canada, Greenland. And I still think largely on balance that's the case. Nevertheless, he strikes Iran. You know, he's pussyfooting around with Putin. But the way that he's treating key allies in this part of the world, especially Japan. Mm. I mean, Japan is so critical to the United States. It is the number one ally in Asia. And yet Trump, as well as with the Koreans, Trump is basically sort of hitting them around the head, especially with the tariffs. But those countries are closer to China than we are, obviously. They have more reason than we do to fear an America that's withdrawing into itself. So I think we need to get a bit realistic about what this new America means, but I sense a great reluctance within the national security community to call it out. Mm. Now, clearly this is something you don't necessarily always do publicly, but one can only hope that the private thinking is going on for what a post-American world might mean. But, yeah, Trump is chaotic. I don't think he really knows what he wants to do in terms of a trade with China and policy with China more broadly. But it could end up being that Trump strikes some sort of grand bargain with China that allows China to basically be the most influential in this part of the world, right? Mm. What does that mean for us?
For us.
Mm. How do we accommodate this? Mm. How do we get used to it?
Well, one thing that Donald Trump has been pushing us to do is to increase defence spending. And one of your fellow lecturers, former Deputy Prime Minister John Anderson, has argued that we need to be putting more into defence, not just in spending, but in encouraging young people to sign up and serve. What's your response to that?
Look, so much of this comes from the way in which the China threat narrative has been really sort of injected into the Australian debate in a way that it was during the Cold War and in a way that it was even during the 1890s. The way in which all of these old Cold War slogans and epithets have been dusted off and redeployed, I don't think has been healthy. Now, the government says they're spending the most they ever have in peacetime. Do we really think China is going to attack? Sure. The first job of any government is to defend the continent, to defend its sovereign territory. But, you know, the key point about more defence spending, Julia, is where are the trade-offs? You know, this is a political culture where, you know, the Australian people are used to the government being quite interventionist in infrastructure, in health, in education, in welfare, in providing a safety net. So tell me what gives. By all means, tell me about the 3.5%, but what has to be sacrificed and which politician at the moment has the courage to face the Australian people and say, you've got to give up A, B and C because we're in the most threatening circumstances. You know, this is the issue at the moment. I think we are talking up the uncertainty, which there is, but we're talking it up to such a level.
Why?
Well, I think because we are spooked by China's military modernisation. And, Yes, granted, there is a lack of transparency about it. But the idea that China would attempt an invasion of the continent, I think, is not accurate. Mm. You know, we need to be, I think, thinking more and more about what are the other types of armaments and defence capabilities that we can employ to make this country not a great prospect to invade, right? So being a bit more spiky. But in terms of recruitment, I mean, I do find it interesting that, again, over the last 20 to 30 years, when successive governments have made the Anzac legend the kind of core characteristic of what it means to be Australian, none of that seems to have really had an impact on recruitment levels. I mean, for AUKUS, for example, we are flat-out crewing the Collins-class submarines. They have a crew of roughly 60 sailors. Mm. Virginia-class submarines have a crew of about 135. How are we going to crew the existing Collins plus new Virginia, transferred Virginia-class submarines, and then...
But this is what John Anderson is arguing, that we need to be working on that. And in fact, even fixing things like housing, where you will defend a country in which you have your own plot, in which you have your own place.
Yeah, well, I think society has changed a lot. And I think this is one of the problems that a lot of democracies face at the moment. These are democracies that have had relative peace and strategic calm for a long time. Mm. How do you generate within the younger population who are of a fighting military age, how do you generate the kind of enthusiasm that is going to prompt these people to enlist? Mm. Now, this is a problem that the Japanese are facing. Certainly the Finns have no problem because they're right next to the Russian bear. So it's not as much of a problem in some of those Scandinavian countries, but generating the will in a democracy now where there are so many distractions, where the political culture is simply not used to war fighting or even the prospect of war fighting, I think it's very difficult. But I do think the big challenge is getting a government that is going to front up to the Australian people and say, here are the sacrifices and the trade-offs. Mm. That's a difficult argument.
So this year's Boyer lectures have been about democracy, and Australia is a radical experiment in democracy that is largely held in the sense of non-partisan and independent electoral authority. Mm. We have compulsory voting. We have we had suffrage relatively early for women and so on. And Justin Wolfers, as our first lecturer, spoke about how important those institutions were, how they put us at the forefront of global practice when it came to democracy, how we've remained robust and how much we need to preserve them. Others say, well, we really need to be worried as well about the hollowing out of the centre, of a dwindling of trust in political parties and in politicians, and foreign interference and corruption. And when you look at these institutions that we've been talking about, and which so many of us take for granted, which arguably is part of its success as a system, how does that relate to the story we tell about ourselves and the world and the stance we take in the world?
Well, I mean, I think Australia has a good story to tell and always has had a good story to tell about political stability, right? That is that it has been able to project itself to the world as a modern, outward-looking, prosperous, competitive economy with a society which has, let's face it, in the post-British, post-imperial era, has been able to successfully integrate migrants from over 130 countries around the world. And multiculturalism has worked, right? In terms of providing social cohesion and national cohesion, yes, there's been a few uncomfortable, discordant moments along the way throughout the 80s and 90s with Pauline Hanson, Cronulla Beach, and we're facing potentially another one at the moment. But the vast middle, I don't think, are interested in being sort of carried to the extremes. Now, that doesn't mean we should be complacent. There are circumstances at the moment, such as, you know, the difficulty of young Australians having access to housing, you know, the sorts of debt that young Australians will carry into their adult lives. There are certainly some elements of society that are going to need some fairly urgent attention, I think, by governments to make sure that the seeds are not sown for this kind of discontent that is roiling the United States and many European countries. So the key is not to take the eye off the democratic ball and not to be complacent. But I think there is a very strong record there of Australian, you know, it's got a robust democracy that's always served itself very well. But, and, you know, the cry of snarling nationalism has never really resonated in the political culture of this country. Those who have tried to appeal to that force have generally fallen foul of it. And that is a good thing about Australia, that it doesn't have this kind of on-your-sleeve, aggressive nationalism that it feels the need to sort of project everywhere. We should have a quiet confidence about, I think, the challenges that we face, but some of them, like housing, do need urgent attention.
That was James Curran, author and professor of modern history from the University of Sydney. And that concludes this year's Boyer Lectures for 2025, which we hope has provided some important ignition points for debates about the future of Australia's democracy, the need to be alert to potential challenges to it, and the critical importance of preserving a way of life that is fair, open, and free. Thanks to radio producer Gail Bozerio and sound engineer Simon Branthwaite. I'm Julia Baird, and it's been my absolute pleasure and honour to act as curator and executive producer of this year's Boyer series. Thank you for listening. And don't forget, you can listen again to all the lectures via the ABC Listen app, or you can watch the lectures on TV anytime. Just visit ABC iView.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.